We're in Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8, we'll read the first 10 verses. Mark chapter 8, verse 1 says, "In those days the multitude, being very great, and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples unto him and said unto them, Have compassion on the multitude, because they have now been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away fasting to their own houses, they will faint by the way, for many of them came from far. And his disciples answered him, From whence can a man satisfy these men with bread here in the wilderness? And he asked them, How many loaves have you? And they said, 7. And he commanded the people to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks and brake and gave to the disciples to set before them. And they did set before them before the people. And they had a few small fishes, and he blessed and commanded to set them also before them. So they did eat and were filled, and they took up of the broken meat that was left 7 baskets. They that had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. And straightway he entered into a ship with his disciples and came into the parts of Dalmatia." This past week, I was on the interstate between Cabot and Searcy and was coming home from down that area and came across drove by a car that was pulled over off the side of the interstate. And there was a lady, looked to be about 60, 65 years old, who was walking around from the passenger side of the car around to the other side. And she had her right blinker on, like you would do if you were pulling off the interstate off on the shoulder there. And the thought crossed my mind, wondering if she needed help. She was broken down and needed help. And it was between, I don't know if you're familiar with that portion of interstate, but between Cabot and BB, there are a couple of exits just a mile or two apart, two or three pretty close together. And as I passed by, I had to make the decision, am I going to stop and see if this lady needs help? Now, how do I make that decision? I'll tell you how that process that I went through in deciding whether or not to stop. The first thing that came to my mind was a thought that I have always had for years, is what would I want someone to do if my wife were stopped on the side of the road? And the answer to that is that if there was a man, if she needed to stop with a broke down vehicle, and there was a man that came by that was a nice man who had no ulterior motives in mind, I would prefer that he stop and see if she needed help, if nothing else, to stay there with her until I got there, or something, to be considerate of whether or not she needed help. That would be the way I would prefer my wife to be treated. So that's the first thought that always comes to my mind when I see a lady on the side of the road. The next thing that came to my mind was several thoughts, and not in any particular order, but things that I also considered. Number one, does it look like she's broke down? The trunk wasn't up, the hood wasn't up, just her right blinker was on. Another thought that I had, she probably has a cell phone. Everybody has cell phones nowadays. She probably has a cell phone. Another thought that I had was, what will she think if I pull over in a pickup truck that looks like it'd be a construction worker of some sort? I may scare her to death. Just pulling off the road will make her nervous. I had that thought. By the time I had several of these thoughts, I was already pastor. But there's an exit less than a mile ahead of me. And so I had some other thoughts. I'm trying to get back home so I can go to work. She probably got a cell phone. It didn't look like she was having car trouble. Whoever she's called is probably almost there by now. By the time I had those thoughts, I was past the exit. But a couple miles ahead, there's another exit. So I had some more thoughts. She probably got a cell phone. Her husband's probably there by now. By the time I pull off at this exit and cross over and get back on and go down past her and get off the exit and come back there, she'd probably be gone. She looked like she was getting back in the driver's seat. She's probably a quarter mile behind me on the interstate. I could pull off here and kind of wait and see if she comes by. By the time I get back around and get back on, she's going to be gone. I'll never find her. She'll be gone. She probably got a cell phone. So what do you think I did? I came home. It took me every bit of an hour to quit thinking about that. Not that it was bothering me maybe as much as it should have. But I want to talk to us today just about being considerate. And the title of the message, if you have an outline there, is Dealing with Impractical Considerations. Here I was trying to decide whether or not to stop and having to overcome four or five considerations that came to my mind that seemed so impractical, that seemed so unlikely that the effort I would have to put into to stop would be worth it. And being considerate is a character trait that we need to develop, that we should have in our lives. And in this passage this morning, I want us to look at some things about Jesus' interaction in these 10 verses that show how he dealt with being considerate and how his disciples deal with this as well. It won't be an extremely long sermon, but let's consider the points. Number one is we need to learn to see needs beyond our own. We need to learn to see needs beyond our own. I was busy. I had places to go. I had things to do. But I need to be able to look at needs that are needs beyond mine, that are other people's needs that I am faced with. Jesus here is in Decapolis, and he is there with a multitude, and Jesus sees the needs of these people. They are hungry. They have been there with him for 3 days, he says, without anything to eat. And we're going to talk a little bit about how that came to be as well in a little bit. But to be able to see the needs that people have. And not just see them, but really see them. There's something that I'm calling the curse of being comfortable. Sometime we find ourselves in a, I don't want to call it a rut, but just in our normal routine of life. And we've become comfortable with that. We do the same, pretty much the same thing. We go through the routine, we get up, we go to work, we do these things, and we know what the routine is. We know what is expected of us, and we've kind of become comfortable with that. And then we're faced with something where someone else has a need, and it breaks us out of our comfort zone. It costs us something. We have to alter our routine. We have to do things differently that make us or cause us some measure of discomfort. And if we were honest, I would imagine most of us would say, really, honestly, we don't like that. I would rather not be uncomfortable. I would rather not, at times, be bothered. But there are always people who need help. Sometimes it's me. Sometimes it's my neighbor. All of us face times when we have needs. The curse of being busy. In the culture in which we live, most people's time is so accounted for that they cannot afford to be involved in other people's lives. They have to work X amount of hours a week, and they cannot afford not just to get involved in somebody else's life, they cannot afford to get sick themselves. They cannot afford to miss work because their money is so tight and they live from paycheck to paycheck so closely that when an opportunity arises to do something to meet needs that someone else has, they cannot afford to do it. They're operating on too thin a line financially, too thin a line with their time and their resources. So many people that are in this church or in the people that have been exposed to our mission in Guatemala would like to go. But what has to happen? They have to take off work, miss work, and it is hard to do. It is hard to find yourself in that situation. And I want to just challenge you to do this last thing that it says under number one, to order your life, to make your life such that you have the time, that you are able to help. There's a verse in Ephesians, I think it is, that has always grasped my attention for years. And it talks about a negative thing, but I want you to listen to how it makes a contrast. Where Paul says, let him that stole steal no more. So here's the negative. If you're a thief, quit stealing. Let him that stole steal no more. Now here's the contrast. But rather, let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good. Now there's your contrast. Quit stealing, but rather work. Do what is good. But now the rest of the verse, notice the rest of it. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing that is good, that he may have to give to him that needs. There is a purposeful work. Not that I may work to consume things upon myself, but that I may have to give to somebody who needs help. How many of us work with that purpose? I don't. I don't know that I have ever worked a day in my life for the purpose of having something to give, so that I may have something to give to somebody who needs it. I don't know if I've ever done that. Every chance I get, I don't work. Can we order our lives? Can we purposely construct our day and our week and our month and the hours of each day with a purpose in mind, that we may be able to accumulate something so that we can give to those in need? We need to learn to see needs beyond our own. Number two, we need to learn to see spiritual hunger when it is near. Here, these people are with Jesus, and they have been with Jesus for 3 days, and apparently have had very little, if anything, to eat for 3 days. How in the world can that be? Would you listen to any Bible teacher that you know for 3 days and not stop and eat lunch? I wouldn't. I don't think. I don't think I've ever been that caught up in what I've been listening to. I can understand Jesus teaching and ministering for 3 days without food. I can understand Jesus doing that. I can see that easily. But it's hard for me to see people following him around with no food, listening to him teach for 3 days. There is something that motivates them. And I think that perhaps at least part of what it is in some of their hearts is a spiritual hunger. There is an emptiness there that they sense can be filled with Jesus. Things that distract our thoughts from the eternal. If we are able to sense spiritual needs in those people around us, we have to have our thoughts ordered in such a way that we are paying attention. If when I'm around those who are in my sphere of influence, all that I think about is the ball game or whatever trivial things we might talk about, very seldom will I ever notice the spiritual condition of that person. Somehow we have to be able to be thinking about that person's spiritual life in order to be able to sense where they're at. Our thoughts have to be not cluttered with just junk and stuff. We need to be able to see spiritual hunger and to recognize it when it's in our midst. Number three, we need to see the potential of our own resources. What did Jesus do here? Jesus tells his disciples, he said, these people have been with me for 3 days and have had nothing to eat. If I send them home now, they haven't had anything to eat for 3 days. Some of them have had a long trip. They may faint on the way because they had nothing to eat. And here are his disciples. You remember a few weeks ago when we talked about where Jesus fed the 5,000, you remember what his disciples' comments were? The disciples at that point said, send these people away so they can go get them something to eat. Their solution was send them away, let them go find themselves something to eat. They don't say that here, but Jesus asked the disciples a question, what is it that you have? I can't send them away hungry. What do you have? And I'm sure in the disciples' mind, what they had is not worth considering. We have a few loaves of bread and a few fish, and here's 4,000 people. Let's forget that option. It's impractical. It's not worth considering. But the same question could be asked of us. What is it that you have that you can use to minister? Are resources necessary? Does it take money to help people? No. At least not always. Does it take your time to help people? Sometimes, but not always. What resources do you have? Do you have to have great talents? Do you have to have great musical ability to be able to help someone? Do you have to be able to articulate yourself and be a great orator to minister? No. God can take small things and accomplish big things with them. He has not chosen many that are mighty and noble, but He's chosen the weak and the small of this world to confound the wise. What is it that we have to minister with? Number four, we need to believe that God can multiply our efforts. We need to believe that God can multiply our efforts. Back when Jesus fed the 5,000, you remember they took up some baskets of food left over. You remember how many baskets it was? Was it 12? I think it was 12 baskets of food left over. It's interesting that here, the word basket is a different type of basket. All right? And when he fed the 5,000, they took up 12 baskets. And that basket was a Jewish basket that was a small basket big enough to carry your lunch in. So this is like a lunch box, we might would say. 12 baskets, about this size, you might say, left over of food when he fed the 5,000. Here, this is a Gentile word for basket. And it's the same basket, the same type of basket, the same size basket that the Apostle Paul was let down over the city wall. That's not a lunch basket, I don't think. This is a big basket. And here he takes up, how many is it, seven? Seven baskets. This is a laundry basket. Okay? There are baskets and then there are baskets. God can take a few small loaves. God can take the limited resources that you have, the limited resources that I have, and God can do some big things with it. He can multiply our efforts. I know you've heard this before from me and probably from other sources as well, but the power of multiplication. The power of multiplication. You take, for instance, God's promise to Abraham. He told Abraham, Abraham, I'm going to make you of you a great nation. I'm going to multiply you and multiply your descendants so that they will be as the stars in the heaven. They'll be as the sands at the seashore. I'm going to multiply. But sometimes that thread of God's blessing and of God's work gets incredibly thin. I want you to consider one thing, and I'm certainly not saying what ifs necessarily here, but think of what God has promised to Abraham. God's promise of him a great nation, and we know that that eventually promise was fulfilled and has indeed is fulfilled even today. But at one point, the thread of that promise, the lifeline of that promise, depended upon one man. One man who's not even given a name. He may, or at least in the Genesis 24, he's not given a name. He's not named. The servant of Abraham. And God's told, or Abraham told his servant to go back to his hometown and find a wife for Isaac. And God's promise to Abraham to make his seed as the sands of the sea are dependent, or this promise is an extremely thin thread at this point. It is dependent upon one man. We don't even know his name. Who leaves and goes, and he comes to the place and he asks God this: God, would you grant favor to me today? And here is one man who does, perhaps it's a big thing, but in light of all the things around him, it's a small thing that he does. And yet, God takes that small thing and it makes an incredible answer to a promise from. How many of you know in the Bible who Hannah was? Hannah. What was her husband's name? What was it? Something like that. I wouldn't have a clue if I hadn't looked it up last night. But I think you're right. Elkanah. We don't know her husband's name. What do we know about Hannah? One thing. One thing. She had a son. And she gave her son to God. And God took that one gift, a small gift that it was, we might would think, and did incredible things. Who was Suzanne Wesley? Was it John Wesley's wife? Is it John Wesley's mother? Okay. What else do we know about Suzanne Wesley? She had a lot of house full of kids. She had two sons at least named Charles and John. Okay, I don't know a whole lot else about her. But what we do know is the fruit of her life as seen in her children. One lady, Fanny Crosby. Who knows Fanny Crosby? What do we know about Fanny Crosby? Blind. If anyone had a reason, you would think, for it to be impractical for them to minister much, it would be someone who is blind, wouldn't it? A young girl at a real young age given wrong medicine for her eyes, and it blinded her. Lived her life in blindness, and yet God used her to write over 5,000. 5,000. Many of them that I'm sure most of us have sung. John Bunyan. You know what John Bunyan attributed his salvation to, other than, of course, the grace of God? Hearing three or four older women have a talk about how God had changed their life. One conversation between three or four old women, and God used it to convert him. Did you ever think about where these 4,000 people came from? Jesus is in Decapolis. The last time he's been to this place or this area before. The last time he was here, he was asked to leave. The last time he was here, he left one man behind that wanted to go with him. You remember? The man that he cast the demons out of. The man said, I want to go with you. And what did Jesus tell him? Stay here and tell people what great things God has done for you. Now Jesus is back. And there are 4,000 people. Reckon it was because of this man's testimony, what God had done? I don't know. Doesn't tell us. But I suspect that perhaps that it was. And then lastly, we need to act. And we need to act now. There are things that you can do. There are things that I can do to serve God, to minister to others, to help people who have needs. We do not need to wait for a better time. We do not need to wait until it is not raining. We do not need to wait until we have more resources. We need to act now with what we have. You know, we have talked, especially in elder board meetings, as we go through the finances of the church. It astounds me. It never ceases to amaze me. And there have been numerous times that I have worked the numbers, looking at how many people come to this church on an average Sunday morning, and looking at our offerings, and looking at the amount of dollars that we give, either through the Feed the Sheep shop, or to Guatemala, or to Love the Child, or to Answers in Genesis, or to Burma. And you don't know how many times I have thought we may have to start cutting back because the economy's bad, you know, people are losing their jobs and this and that and all this type of stuff. But if anything, it seems to me like the last 2 or 3 months, the percentage that we give to meet needs somewhere, if anything, it's increased. The offerings are still, as far as I can, Ray probably knows a little more than I do about it. I'm sure, I know he does. But as far as the dollars, it seems that they have not dropped off. People have lost jobs. People have moved. But our giving is still the same. We are giving. And per capita, I'm amazed at what we have done. But I want to encourage you not to look at that as a group, but just to look at it as you. How do you help? How can you help those who have needs that you are around? We need to act. We need to act. Now, I need to help people in need. And I need to do it now. I don't need to wait till a better day. I need to do it as the need arises. Would you pray with me? Father, we have a perfect example, of course, in Jesus, of seeing needs and meeting needs. God, would you help me that I would not be so God, wanting to analyze every situation that comes up so much that I miss opportunities. People are hungry, and I wonder, try to figure out why. People are hurting, and I want to analyze or overanalyze why they are hurting. God, help us to embrace them as we correct situation. Not hold them at arm's length until they prove to us they're worthy of our help. God, make us, conform us to behaving, Lord, like Jesus did.